So I want you to listen for a moment to these words. These are the words of Tom Inglis. So Tom is a former sociology professor in UCD, and he was writing these words 5 years ago. Now listen to these. There was a time not so long ago when the Republic of Ireland was a homogeneous society and culture. The vast majority of people were white, English-speaking and Catholic. Over the last 50 years, the cultural map of Ireland has changed dramatically. Ireland has become a multinational, cosmopolitan, globalized society. Social relations have become less formal. People see and understand themselves as discrete, free, independent individuals who are not bound by the family, community, and religion into which they were born. Now, Tom is writing 5 years ago, and if anything, this has only increased in the years since he has written the changes in Irish culture and Irish society. And we see those changes all around us, don't we, in the wider culture. And of course, there aren't just changes in the wider culture. There are changes within all the many subcultures and mini cultures that we experience day to day in our lives. So it might be the change in culture from moving from one classroom to another classroom. This teacher was strict, but this teacher not so strict. That's a different culture, isn't it? It might be the change in culture when you go from one job to another job, and this group of friends, they would never say a bad word about anybody. This group of friends are constantly talking behind each other's backs. That's a change in culture, isn't it? It might be the generational change that we see around us as we grow older and we see a new generation coming after us. There can be a change in the culture along with that generational change. So I don't know, was it Luther or somebody like that who said that all of history is like a drunken man getting on a horse? So he gets on, he falls off one side, then the next generation gets on and falls off the other side. There is constant change in the culture at large and in our mini subcultures. Now, of course, change isn't always bad. It isn't necessarily a bad thing. But what we need to keep our eye on is how we are responding to that change. How are we responding to that change? So are we getting swept along with the changes of the culture without thinking them through? Or are we staying committed to what we believe about who God is and what he has done through Jesus? So how do we do that? Well, we'll see in this passage that in order to stay committed to God and his ways, we first of all need to see that God is committed to us. God is committed to us. And so we're going to look a little bit at what God's commitment to us is like, because that is what is going to enable us to stay committed to him. So the first thing we want to see is that God's commitment to us means that sometimes there are consequences for what we do. Sometimes there are consequences for what we do. So what were Israel doing? We see what Israel were doing in verse 11. The Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord and served the Baals or the Baals. So they did evil before God, who was the Lord, and then they were serving these other gods, these other lords with a small L. So the Baals or the Baals were like these mini gods of the Canaanite people, the people in which the land they had moved into. Now, you might be thinking that sounds very foreign to us, and it is. We don't have Baal worship going on around us today. But what we need to realize is this word serve is all important. Essentially, what was happening was that instead of doing what God was wanting them to do, they were doing what the culture around them was wanting them to do. The Baal worshippers were wanting them to do. You see, Bob Dylan was right when he said that you got to serve somebody, because there's something within us that wants to do what somebody or something or someone else wants us to do. And the question is, who are you going to serve? It might be that you are getting into a relationship with somebody in college, and you know that what they want you to do, what they're asking you to do, is not what God would have you do. And the question is, are you going to walk in God's ways? Are you going to serve God? Or are you going to walk in the ways of this person or the culture around? The reality is that we're constantly needing to serve somebody or something, and it might be ourselves. The question is whether we will serve God. Now we need to see why it is important to consider what Israel were doing. Why were they doing what they're doing? The root of it, we find it in verse 10. Look at what happens in verse 10. In the second half of it, another generation grew up who neither knew the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. So they don't know God. They haven't heard about what God has done. It hasn't taken hold of them. It hasn't been real for them in their experience of life. You see, there's this good, loving, kind God who, it says in verse 12, has brought the people out of Egypt. And he has done this in a loving, kind, compassionate way. They're working hard in the baking sun and he delivers them. He rescues them, not because they've done anything special, but because of his love for them. And now he wants them to live in a way that reflects that love. But this new generation is growing up who have not experienced God, who have not heard about God in this way or what he has done. And that is why, understandably, they start to serve other gods. They start to live in their own ways or the ways of the culture around them. There's this connection between knowing God and walking in his ways. And in fact, it is a very personal connection. It's a very personal connection. God doesn't just come up with random things for us to do. He comes up with things for us to do that show us his character. When he says to us, do not steal, do not commit adultery, do not lie. If we lived in a society where people lived like that, it would reflect God's character. That he is good and loving and kind. But it is a personal thing while people walk in their own ways. It is personal to God when we don't walk in his ways. In fact, it is so personal that the way in which it's described in verse 17 is like a spouse who says goodnight to their family and then goes out and sells themselves. That's the way it's spoken of in these verses. And it's no wonder that God is angry as a result. Look at verse 12. In verse 12, they aroused the Lord's anger. In verse 14, in his anger against Israel. In verse 20, the Lord was very angry. Now, it's not comfortable to hear these words about God, that he was angry. And perhaps you're sitting there thinking, this is why I don't like the God of the Old Testament, because he's angry. And the God of the New Testament is love and loving. But we need to realize that that's a false, we're driving a wedge in there that shouldn't be there. We need to realize that it is sometimes because God is so loving that he is angry when people walk away from him. I remember years ago listening to this interview between Peter McVerry and Ray Darcy. So Peter McVerry, as you know, is this man who works with homeless people around Dublin, and he is so caring and loving and kind. And in the interview, Ray was obviously struck by his love for the homeless people that he worked with. And Ray asked him at one point, do you ever get angry? And I think in Ray's mind, he kind of had this view of Peter McVerry that was a little bit kind of one-dimensional, that he's just kind and loving all the time. So he asked him, do you ever get angry? And Peter McVerry said, without a pause, he said, of course I get angry. Of course I get angry. I get angry with a system that is failing people and allowing them to die in the streets. Of course I get angry when I see people hurting themselves and their family members with the decisions that they're making. It is because I love them that I get angry. And we need to be able to hold those two realities in our mind when it comes to God. It is because he is committed to his people that sometimes there are consequences for what we do. There are consequences for what we do. It's like the parent who allows the child to go to school without the homework in the bag because they have asked them 17 times, please put your homework in your bag. They don't put the homework in the bag. The parent allows them to go and face the consequences. Is that because the parent doesn't love them? Of course not. It is because the parent loves them and is committed to them that they allow them sometimes to face the consequences. And what we need to see here is that sometimes God will allow us to face the consequences of our decisions to serve something or someone other than Him. It might be that we have entered into that relationship with somebody and we have made decisions that are not pleasing to God. And He hands us over to the consequences of those decisions sometimes. And it is not enjoyable, it is not pleasant, and yet He does it because He is committed to us and He wants us to taste what it is like to walk in a way other than His. He will do that sometimes. And of course in Judges we see this generational dynamic going on where one generation has not known the Lord, has not known what God has done, and this is why we are committed to youth ministry, not just youth leaders, but as a church family, because we want the next generation to know God, to know the Lord, to know what it is to walk in His ways, and to protect them from the consequences of doing otherwise. Listen to these words from Kevin DeYoung. Kevin says, make no mistake, no matter how good your church, no matter how strong your family, no matter how gospel-centered your Christian school, if your children or grandchildren are even remotely engaged with contemporary culture, and they are being taught by 1,000 memes and messages every week. The Christian family, Christian church, and Christian school must not assume that the next generation will accept the conclusions that seem so obvious to older generations. We must talk about the things our kids are already talking about among themselves. We must disciple. We must be countercultural. We must prepare them to love and teach them what biblical love really means. And listen to this. We must pass on the right beliefs and the right reasons for those beliefs. We have to be actively, intentionally teaching the next generation about God, what He has done, and what He is like. And of course, it isn't just a generational thing. Anytime we move from one culture to the next, one job to another job, we need to be reminding ourselves, who is God? What has He done? I want to walk in His ways. I don't want to face the consequences of going astray from His ways. So we need to realize that God is committed to us, and sometimes that means that we will face the consequences. But God's commitment to us also means that He has compassion on us. So in verse 15, we see that people are in great distress. At the end of verse 15, does God leave them in that distress? Absolutely not. What does He do? Verse 16, He raised up judges who saved them. So He saves them from the full consequences of what they deserve. They have forsaken Him. They have abandoned Him. In verse 12, it says, they forsook the Lord. But God does not hand them over to the full consequences of what they deserve. He has compassion on them. In fact, this is the way He constantly deals with His people. Why did He deliver them out of Egypt? Because He heard their cries and He has compassion on them. Why does He send judges throughout the book of Judges to save them? We see it in verse 18. They are groaning under those who oppress them, and He has compassion on them. He has pity on them. This is how God deals with His people. In fact, even though there are times when we turn away from Him, we know that He does not forsake His people. Why? How do we know this? Because when Jesus dies on the cross, He says, my God, why have you forsaken me? And the answer to that question, the reason that God in that moment has allowed Jesus to feel the distance of God, the anger of God, the reason He has allowed Jesus to feel that is for us, that we would never be forsaken. Even though He will allow us at times to taste the consequences of what we have done, He will never forsake us. He has compassion on us, and He raises up judges in the book of Judges who save them. It's interesting, there's a connection. As Judges goes on, there's a connection between the judge and the people. So in verse 19, we see when the judge dies, The people return to their ways. It's as though the judge is pulling out this spring and straightening out the life of the people. And the judge dies, the spring is let go of, and they return to ways that are more corrupt. So there's a problem. When the judge dies, the people just go back to the way they were. So what does God do ultimately? He sends a judge who dies and then is raised from the dead. He sends Jesus to die for us and then is raised from the dead. So rather than going through this cycle like there is in Judges, where it gets worse and worse and worse, as a judge dies and the people go back to their ways, we have this great judge who will never die. And if we trust in him, if we are believing in him, we are united to him forever. That in fact, even though our desire for him and our desire to walk in his ways will ebb and flow, that in fact, because he has overcome death, we are safe in him. Why do we need to hear that? We need to hear that because we have faced some consequences of what we have done wrong in the past, in life before we became a Christian, or even life since becoming a Christian. There are decisions that we have made, there are words that we have spoken that haunt us. And we need to hear this, that God has compassion on us. And what do we do when those thoughts come to mind? What does God do? He doesn't say, here's a shovel, now dig your way out of this. He says, I have compassion on you. He hears those who cry out to him and recognize their need for him again. He says, not here's a shovel to dig your way out. He says, here is my son who has overcome every enemy on your behalf. Cry out to him. So God's commitment to us, it means that sometimes we face the consequences of our sin. And it means that he has compassion on us. And the last thing it means, or the last thing it is complex. God's commitment to us is complex. So last week we saw why the Israelites were in this mess. So there was a few reasons. So they were in this mess, first of all, because the Canaanites had chariots made out of iron. They were also in this mess because the Canaanites really wanted to live in the land. This week we've seen they're in this mess because they have given themselves to serving the Baals. We've also seen this week that they're in this mess because God has handed them over to the consequences of what they've done. So there's loads of factors going on here. It's like if you ask me, come across me drinking a smoothie and you ask me, why are you drinking the smoothie? I could tell you why I'm drinking the smoothie, because I'm thirsty, because I like smoothies, because the date on the smoothie was nearly ready to go off, because when I'm finished the smoothie, I'm going to cut the bottle in half and make a little boat for a hamster. So there's loads of different reasons why I might be drinking the smoothie. And there's loads of different reasons why Israel have got to this point. But what God wants them to realize is that he has more reasons. He has more purposes for them, even as they find themselves at this point. Let's just look at the two purposes that he highlights for us. Verse 1, these are the nations the Lord left to test all those Israelites who had not experienced any of the wars in Canaan. So God leaves these nations to test them. What's the test? Verse 22, I will use them to test Israel and see whether they will keep the way of the Lord. Or another way of translating it, whether they will take care to walk in his ways. So there's many reasons why Israel are here. But one of God's purposes is to see whether they will walk in his ways. Will they remember who he is, what he has done, and live accordingly? That's another reason why they are here. Or a second reason why they are here is to teach Israel. In verse 2, he did this only to teach warfare to the descendants of the Israelites who had not previous battle experience. You see, warfare at this time, we see what warfare is like. So when the people are entering into the land first, into Jericho, what is warfare for the people of Israel? They are weaker, they are fewer in number, they are less well equipped. Warfare in Jericho was walk around the city seven times and depend on me. And what God wants to teach the people here is dependence on him. He wants to teach them dependence on him. And so there's two other reasons why they are in this situation. To test them, to see what are they going to be walking in God's ways, knowing that he has delivered them to live in his ways, and to teach them dependence on him. As they feel the pressures of living in a culture where they are in the minority, where there are many different worldviews around them, where their friends and the people, even that they are married to in some cases, have different views of the world, he's going to teach them dependence. And what is dependence? It is crying out on God, God, I am out of my depth. I cannot do this. Please help me again. Please strengthen me again. As we think about our own culture, it is... In some ways it's intriguing, in some ways it's saddening to think about why we are where we are as a culture, as a nation. Lots of reasons perhaps that we could give why we are where we are. How do we get here? It's interesting, isn't it, to analyze it, but it's not the most important thing we need to be thinking about. The most important thing we need to be thinking about is, are we going to be careful to walk in God's ways, the God who has loved us, who has given his son for us, who has given his son over to death for us? Are we willing and wanting to walk in his ways? Do we know what it is to walk in his ways when it comes to our relationships, to our workplace, to our marriages, to our friendships, to our parenting? Do we want to walk in his ways rather than in the ways of the culture when they contradict one another? Are we willing to allow God to teach us dependence on him? That is not easy, is it? It is not easy to feel dependent. We want to be independent, and yet we have an opportunity as a church in the culture around us to cry out to God because we feel our weakness. We feel our inability. Where does dependence start? It starts by crying out to him. I was in a meeting on Thursday, and it wasn't in Grosvenor, it was elsewhere, but we were having this conversation about some of the conversations that are going on in society around us. And at one point in the meeting, having dwelt on it for hours and hours and hours, this particular subject, one of the other pastors in the room said, "What is this showing us? It is showing us that we need to be crying out to God for wisdom, because we are dependent on him in this situation." And so we need to appreciate that God's commitment to us is complex. It's complex that there are many reasons why we are where we are in our lives. But to not get distracted by that complexity and to allow him to teach us dependence on him again. Years ago, I was chatting to a friend in the States, and she said that she had been caught up in floods, hurricane floods, like massive floods, deluges of water, biblical floods for want of a better phrase. And in order to escape the flood, she climbed up on the roof of her house. And her house was a timber frame house, and she was looking down kind of at the stairs in her house, and to her amazement and fright, the stairs started to float away from her. That's what she thought was happening in all the water that had flooded her house. The stairs started to float away. But then as she looked more carefully, what she realized was that it wasn't the stairs that was floating away from her. It was actually that the whole house, it was a timber frame house, had lifted off its foundations and was starting to flow down the river. The river had flooded its banks. It was lifting the whole house. The stairs were still where it was supposed to be, and she was moving with the house. The challenge for us in a culture that feels like it's all change at the moment is to not move off the foundations of the fact that God is a God of compassion, that God is a God who has sent his son to die for us, to deliver us so that we might walk in his ways. It's a challenge for us. It's a test for us in many ways. But as we face into that test, as we face into learning dependence on him, we need to remember that God is utterly committed to us in the midst of that, that he will keep us, that he will enable us to teach the next generation, and he will enable us to walk in his ways by his strength. Let's pray.